I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. My colleague and friend and co-host Gordon Chang is traveling. He's in the Pacific Rim in California. Good evening, Gordon.
Good evening, John.
This is how wars start, Gordon. This is how wars start. Generals lie to correspondents in important European publications. Imagine Gideon Rockman as foreign correspondent, a Hitchcock movie, and he travels to Beijing, and a general in the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, by the way, works for the Communist Party, and it isn't just army, it's all, everything's thing, so the Navy's under this. The PLA general tells Gideon Rockman, knowing he's a famous foreign policy correspondent for the Financial Times, the pink paper every morning in London, this is the world according to the British Empire. He tells them, we're not going to make the same mistake of the Japanese in the 1930s. We're not going to the path of militarism. And then Gideon Rockman, our foreign correspondent, trench coat in hand, travels to Beijing, to Tokyo, and he listens to a Japanese official, quote, the Chinese are making exactly the mistakes we made in the 1930s. They are allowing the military to break free from civilian control, and they are challenging American power in the Pacific. Gordon, is the Chinese PLA, is that a state within a state?
Well, it almost is right now, especially because you have weak civilian leadership. And so you have the generals and the admirals telling the civilians what to do. And this is a dangerous situation.
We welcome Stephen Yates, CEO at DC International Advisory. He was in the vice president's office, Vice President Dick Cheney, during the Bush administration. And early on, you will recall, before 9/11, there was a foreign policy in the United States that was a tangle because the Chinese Communist Party chose to order aircraft against one of our surveillance aircraft operating in international space, force it down, take hostages. That was early on in the Bush administration, winter 2001. Cast your mind back. Stephen, a very good evening to you. The Chinese are aggressive, and during 9/11, there wasn't time for it. So it was like this, it was this long pause. But here we are, 2013. Is this a state within a state? And is it making the Japanese mistake of the 1930s, tangling with the U.S. someday?
I think it's very much moving in that direction. I mean, when you look at the direction that great powers move, it tends to be slow, driven by their own logic, not really influenced that much by diplomacy and the well wishes of external powers. And what you have with China is an increasingly fragile political state, a very technologically advanced and enriched military state, and grand territorial claims and grand designs about reshaping the balance of power in its near abroad. And the near abroad is the Pacific, a very, very large strategic area with a lot of U.S. interest at stake. So I think it's very much moving in that direction.
Gordon.
Stephen. You know, we look at American policy towards China. It's always been very helpful to try to engage the Chinese and bring them into the international system. You know, this is a policy that we started in 1972, and in the beginning it sort of worked because we pried the Chinese away from the Soviets. But it seems recently the Chinese have been moving in the wrong direction, becoming much more aggressive and belligerent, and it seems we need to readjust our policies. What do you think?
I think that the United States, like other great powers, is able to influence others when the others really want to move in the direction we say. But when they make a strategic choice, say to pursue nuclear weapons or to challenge us, they don't tell us. They don't telegraph it that well in advance. And we have very limited ability to move them away from a fundamental strategic path. I believe that China made long ago a decision to try to build its strength to challenge America, to push us back from our position in the Pacific at the very least. And I just don't think any amount of smiling and engagement is really going to steer them from that path.
Stephen, in the White House, you see the world from a point of view on high. Do we play the long game compared to the Chinese, or are they the masters of it?
They play the long game better than we do. There are certain sort of tactical elements of changing personnel, whether changing of a president or changing of advisors. We tend to think in smaller chunks of time. They have the continuity of generations of records of what U.S. officials have said and who's done what with whom over the years. They have a much larger apparatus instilling discipline in their system so that you don't have private diplomacy or freelance diplomacy that can happen with an American system. They always have 1,000 people listening to every meeting. So they have a much more deliberate approach that is more appropriate for a longer strategic game.
Gordon.
Well, Stephen, you know, this is very interesting because democracies, you know, we rotate leaders in and out, and you can't have that same continuity that you can have in a Soviet system or a communist system. And this, I think, really just highlights the differences between when you have a representative liberal democracy and when you have a one-party state, don't you think?
Very much so. But, you know, when we have our liberal democratic system, we should be able to rely on the soft institutions within our country, in academia, in the media, longer-standing members in Congress and their staffs, to be the longer record holders, the people pushing for the longer view. I think where the Chinese have really gotten the best of us is they have found ways to weaken those elements that should be our strengths.
Pushing against Japan, I have never been to Japan, and your measure, Stephen, Prime Minister Abe talks tough, and he has made it clear that comes the day when a drone cuts into Japanese airspace, he's going to take a shot. I think that's closer and closer as they start using drones over the Senkakus. Can the Japanese back this up? That is a great big navy and army in China, and the Japanese military, it's first rate, but it's aging and it's outnumbered.
I think they can back it up, at least in a limited exchange. It's always a question of where escalation might go, and that is, I think, the fundamental risk in China-Japanese relations and this competition emerging in East Asia. The United States, for a couple of generations, has been the determining factor in keeping this somewhat constrained and would weigh in with its commitment to our ally. But in the current era, we have much less clear commitments to allies, much less willingness to intervene, and we haven't really stated clearly what our fundamental objective is in this region.
Gordon.
Stephen, when you look at it, what the United States is doing right now, what should we be saying to Japan, and what should we be saying about Japan in connection with the Senkakus?
First and foremost, I think we need to talk about Japan for what it is today. It is now no longer appropriate to talk about the militarized Japan of the imperial era. You now have a very mature democracy behaving responsibly as a stakeholder in the international system. And so when their national security apparatus and prime minister warn of this, the concerns they see, we need to take that very seriously and support a greater audience for those concerns. We should also say thank you whenever we have substantial economies and substantial countries willing to take on more of a burden by acquiring advanced equipment and taking on greater responsibilities. We should share those burdens and basically say thank you for filling in where the United States no longer wants to take the lion's share of responsibility.
April 1st, 2001, mid-air collision, EP-3, Ares-2 signals intelligence aircraft forced down by the PLA Navy. I believe it was done purposefully. Casting back, that's many years ago, Stephen. The Chinese aggression in that instance, did they back off when we pushed back, or was that left undone?
My assessment at the time was that the United States wanted to move on, and we basically decided to let that go. There was a brief time between that April 1st until we made a fundamental decision that we were going to have move forward with the WTO membership process, have permanent normal trade relations. We were not going to question fundamentally the strategic direction of our relationship. And so we basically sent them a $35,000 check. In exchange, in response to a $1 million-plus bill they sent us for holding our crew, and everyone agreed to move on from there. The president questioned whether he might go to APEC that fall after 9/11. The Chinese very, very much wanted him to come. He went. It wasn't a fully satisfactory experience. He went again in January to follow up. And from that point forward, it was essentially smooth sailing in the bath of conventional wisdom from there on China relations.
Gordon, was that the moment they marked us as weak?
Well, yes, if you pay a $35,000 ransom, you are weak, and this was really disgraceful.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the Bush administration. Okay? This isn't about President Obama. This is about China taking advantage of America not wanting to tangle, but two big dogs tend to tangle eventually. The Japanese found that out, and that's what Gideon Rockman is pointing to. Stephen Yates, joining us with his memories of the Bush administration, CEO at DC International Advisory and former advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang, my colleague and co-host, is here, and we're going to a news report from East Turkestan, Xinjiang, the Chinese imperial masters call it. This is west of China. It's a conquered state. The native people to Xinjiang, Turkic origin, are Uyghurs. The news item is Reuters. 11 people killed, 2 injured, China's troubled far west region. Group of people armed with axes and knives attacked a police station on Saturday. Axes and knives. 9 mobs holding knives and axes attacked a police station at Bachu County, killing 2 auxiliary policemen, injuring another 2 policemen, according to a report from xinhuanet.com. The 9 mobs, I'm quoting here, were gunned down on the site and local social order restored to normal. My God. Goodness, Gordon, I could be writing a science fiction novel about a tyranny some 5 million years from now. That is totally agitprop hogwash, all of it.
Yes, you know, you have these stories, and we see them periodically, where, you know, the Chinese complain of terrorism, they complain of the Uyghurs rising up against Chinese rule, and what is it? Do they have AK-47s? No. Do they have rocket-propelled grenades? No. What have they got? They've got knives and they've got axes. You know, and sometimes they got screwdrivers. The point here is that the narrative that we're getting from Beijing is absolutely wrong, that these are people who have somehow been pressed to the point of breaking.
And they were gunned down. And we have no reason to believe that you're going to attack an armed police station with a knife or an axe. That's not good planning. Okay, let's just put it that way. They might be desperate or they might have been murdered. And this is one great big catch-all explanation.
Yes, you know, and the point is that China talks about al-Qaeda in what they call Xinjiang province. Well, you know, if it's going to be al-Qaeda, they're going to be well-trained and they're going to be well-armed. And, you know, all these stories that we hear, these guys have just basically their bare hands and maybe some kitchen utensils.
Alim Saitov, director at Washington-based Uyghur Human Rights Project. Alim, a very good evening to you. This incident last week, Bachu County, I'm immediately denouncing the way the Xinhua Net wrote it up. Is this mass murder? Do we have any independent reporting of what happened? Good evening to you, Alim.
Good evening. What we learned so far is that because of the crackdown in April, one violent incident took place. Some 21 people were killed. As a result, the Chinese government imposed a number of security measures in the same town against the Uyghur people. They start random house searches, search of individuals, harassment on the streets, beatings, and even arrests. So the town people actually took the streets to protest last week in front of the police station. That basically aggressively repressed them since April. But the Chinese police basically fired and killed 4 or 5 of them. As a result, the angry crowd, some of them young people, then attacked a couple of police there, may have killed one or two. Then the police retreat into the police compound, then called the SWAT teams. Then the SWAT teams appeared and began to shoot and kill the young Uyghur men who had no guns or bombs in their hands. When the village people basically protest against the SWAT team, basically urging them to arrest the young people that they want instead of killing them, the SWAT team didn't listen. Instead, they just killed all of the other young Uyghur men.
So
that's actually what transpired.
21 dead in Bachu County, called a terrorist attack. Go ahead, Gordon.
Hey, Lim, what we have seen, you know, all of these incidents essentially is essentially a cycle of repression, and then people through just desperation fight back. Isn't that what's going on here? Essentially, that the Chinese authorities have just really pushed the Uyghurs too far?
Yes. What has been happening is for the past decade, especially after 9/11, the Chinese government took advantage of the tragedy that took place in the U.S., especially in New York. They used the global war on terror as a pretext to justify its heavy-handed repression of the Uyghur people, because Uyghurs happen to be Muslims. So it's very easy for China to say, hey, they're Muslims, their fight against us is terrorism, we're a victim of terrorism, in spite of the fact that China is an authoritarian state, that China uses its military force against not just the Uyghurs, but also Tibetans, their own people. But especially to the Uyghurs, because Uyghurs are Muslims, then the repression was strengthened by the Chinese and intensified by the Chinese authorities. Then the situation has become so bearable for the Uyghur people. Today, if you look at East Turkestan, it is probably the biggest police state in China. And East Turkestan itself is like a concentration camp for the Uyghur people because they cannot live a normal life there. They're being targeted and harassed by the Chinese security forces on a daily basis. And if they want to leave the country, they can't get passports. They simply cannot get passports. They cannot leave the country. So they are stuck. And they have to take, on a daily basis, the repression of the Chinese government and also face policies of cultural genocide, such as the targeting of their identity, their culture, their language, their religious beliefs and practices, their traditions and values. Basically, it is almost a crime to be a Uyghur in China today. It's not only the Chinese government that treats Uyghurs as criminal suspects, because of Chinese government's six-decade propaganda and brainwashing of the massive Chinese people. Unfortunately, a lot of them think Uyghurs are indeed criminals and terrorists. So the treatment of Uyghurs is horrible in China. It's not any different than the Jews treated by the Nazis before the Second World War.
Alim Saitov speaking for an incident, one of many outrages perpetrated by the Chinese conquerors, the authorities, this in Bachu County, 21 dead. There's also torture mentioned of using electric rods to beat the Uyghurs. Reuters reporting from Beijing, that's a success. We have something. We penetrate the darkness in some fashion. Alim Saitov is the director of the Washington-based Uyghur Human Rights Project. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com continues with me. He's in California on the east side of the Asia Pacific Rim. We're going to the west side, to Hong Kong, and we welcome David Feith, who's just back from the Philippine Islands. David writes for the Wall Street Journal editorial. He's a columnist, and he's in Hong Kong, but he traveled into the maw left the eaten up towns and waterfronts and jungle by the typhoon that swept through the Philippines some 2 weeks ago. He traveled to Leyte Island and then on. David, a very good morning to you. You traveled to Manila and then on to Leyte, and you write a column in praise of the military, and especially the U.S. military and the Osprey aircraft and the enormous amount of supplies in there. You saw the devastation in Leyte. Please explain where. Do the map for everybody, because I've never been to the Philippines. Gordon knows it very well. Where were you, David?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. The Philippine Islands, the country is an archipelago of 7,000 islands, and it can roughly be divided into three portions. The northern third has the main island of Luzon, where the capital, Manila, is, and where the former U.S. naval station at Subic Bay, which at one point was the largest foreign U.S. military base, can be found on the west side of Luzon. The middle third of the country is known as the Visayas, and that is right where the typhoon swept through. It's smaller islands, more impoverished, less developed, less good infrastructure, really a terrible place to have a terrible storm arrive with three times the force of Hurricane Katrina. The bottom third of the country is dominated by Mindanao, where among the difficulties there is years of festering Islamist radical and in some cases Al-Qaeda-affiliated insurgency. But the story of the past few weeks takes place in the center of the country, in the Visayas, and the storm in particular is focused around Leyte Gulf, which students of American history might recognize from World War II, when in October 1944, the U.S. Navy won its decisive victory over the Japanese Navy in this Gulf. And if you track the hardest hit areas from the typhoon over the past few weeks, it's almost a perfect semicircle around this Gulf of Leyte, where the U.S. military has a very rich history and is now back leading relief efforts.
Gordon?
David, when you look at the pictures from the areas that were hit by the typhoon, which I've heard is supposed to be the most powerful typhoon that has ever made landfall, I mean, it's just utter devastation. How did you get into those places?
Well, I got in traveling with the U.S. military, and so in a sense, it was easier. I figure if one has to travel in such places, there's no better escort than the U.S. military. So in my case, I began at an airbase in Manila, in the capital, flew down in one case on Osprey Marine aircraft. The Osprey is this rather amazing aircraft that takes off like a helicopter, lands like a helicopter, and flies like an airplane because it has tilt rotor propellers that allow that to happen. Another time I traveled on a U.S. C-130 cargo plane, and so the U.S. military was running regular supply planes down into the typhoon zone, evacuation flights back, and there was some opportunity for journalists, if there was extra space, to find a seat.
David, the scale of the devastation, we're told that 600,000 were dishomed, that the water, the sewage, the electricity had collapsed. My reading of Leyte comes from 1944. You mentioned that's MacArthur liberating the Philippines. He first landed in Leyte, and then they moved to Luzon. Is that the jungles are so thick there, the fighting was entirely on the roads. You couldn't go into the jungle. Is it the same place, and is that a problem?
Well, there's an enormous problem with not just the devastating power of the storm, but the geography and the topography and the poverty, the lack of infrastructure in the area where it hit. And so you not only have the locals living mostly in tin and timber homes that are very easily devastated by not just the winds and the rain, but by essentially the tsunami waves that came, in some cases, up to 12 feet and just wiped away towns. Of course, the effect of that sort of geography where, you know, there's water everywhere, islands are, in many cases, extremely small, and there are people dotted all over the place, the additional difficulty is in trying to get people out and relief in. It's an unbelievable logistical challenge, and even with all of the concentrated attention that the region has had over the past days, it's an amazing illustration of, you know, what it means to have airports and ports and roads and all sorts of basic services and infrastructure that we often don't really think twice about.
Gordon?
David, basically the Philippine government is not doesn't have the capability to deliver aid and certainly doesn't have the capability to exercise governmental functions. Essentially, what I've been hearing and from what you've been saying and also what I've been reading is essentially the only way in and out of these places right now is the U.S. military. Is that right?
That's mostly but not completely right. That certainly seems to be the case for many or perhaps most of the evacuees. And so those who were hardest hit are, you know, massing in places like the Tacloban Airport, waiting in some cases for days for, you know, the proper flight to a proper area elsewhere in the country where they might have family. For some others, and in some cases for aid shipments, there are ways to travel. If you can get generally to the southern Philippines, you can then travel by road and bridge and ferry. But it's difficult.
You were at Tacloban, which is exactly where the 8th and the 6th Army were operating in 1944. And then you went to another town, Ginan. Where is that, David?
So the town of Giwan is a fishing town of about 50,000 people on the far southeastern tip of another province called Samar. It's one of the farthest eastern points of the entire central Philippines, and so it's considered where the storm first made landfall. So this typhoon is traveling east to west from the Pacific Ocean across the Philippine Sea, and it basically hit the country. It hit the first populated area in this town of Giwan, where on Thursday, which was 6 days after the storm, I was able to fly in with the first two U.S. Marine Ospreys that were bringing aid. The Philippine Army had arrived one day before. We were told by the locals when we got there that about 24 hours before, on Wednesday afternoon, the Philippine Army had arrived to begin restoring some semblance of order. And then when the group I was with arrived on Thursday afternoon, that was the first aid that had come. That means the first food, the first water. This was a town that then and still has no electricity, almost no communications. It was extremely hardly hit.
Gordon?
David, do you know if the situation has stabilized there, or is it still desperate for people?
It's a little bit of both. It's improving a bit day by day. At the same time, there are problems that actually rise afresh the farther you get from the storm. In other words, when you have an entire region that doesn't have hospital facilities anymore, what you now have is a major problem where perfectly regular medical needs, whether injury, illness, or even childbirth, accumulate because there is not local medical infrastructure. And if those cases are not tended to, you can have more misery, you know, more illness, more death that's actually not directly related to the storm injuries, but is simply related to the fact that infrastructure is missing and supplies are missing. So in that sense, the urgency remains, and the logistical challenge of getting supplies in is extremely difficult. One of the most interesting things that I heard independently from all different sorts of people in the relief operation over there was that they need supplies more than people, which is to say there are doctors on the ground, in some cases local, in many cases flown in from Europe or from the U.S., but the doctors don't have the tools that they need. The doctors can't set up field operating rooms because they don't have tarp and other things to put over as roofs and to keep the new rain out. Or the Red Cross is deploying a team of 70 people to go and clear an area of debris, but for the 70 people, they only have something like 13 chainsaws.
David Fife is an editorial page writer for the Wall Street Journal Asia, reporting from Guian, G-U-I-U-A-N, the Philippines, the farthest reach, and then Lady Island as well. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. That was the 6th and the 8th Army, 1944, guys. I wanted to get it right for you. This is The Batchelor Show. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com continues with me. We're off to Korea. There is a crisis in the Korean Peninsula. Merrill Newman, 85 years old, grabbed off of an aircraft in North Korea, outbound, tourist, October 26th. We're just learning about it here in the United States, and I'm looking at a London report. But we're joined by someone who had indications this was going on for the last few days, Greg Scarlatu. Greg, a very good morning to you. At 85 years old, you follow very carefully the North Korean provocations and offenses. And there's an American citizen now, a missionary, Christian missionary, has been detained a year, sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. We've spoken of Kenneth Bay. What strikes me about Merrill Newman is that he's a Korean War veteran. He's an officer. He graduated of Palo Alto's Stanford University, graduated master's degree, did finance. He has a wife. They're traveling together. He's prosperous. He's taught as a high school teacher, Red Cross volunteer. I mean, first rate. And they grabbed him. Why? What do they want? And are they capable of charging him with war crimes? Good morning, Greg.
Good evening, John. First and foremost, Merrill Newman is an American hero. We owe him a great debt of gratitude, his hard desire to travel to North Korea. Now we need to make sure that we get him out of there. North Korea is a hostage taker. Several U.S. citizens have been taken by the North Koreans. They have used them as bargaining leverage each and every time they expected that a senior government official or a former senior government official would travel to North Korea to rescue these Americans who were taken hostage. Traveling to North Korea is reckless behavior. We have to understand that. It is reckless because those who travel to North Korea may be subjected to arbitrary arrest, as it happened yet again in the case of this elderly gentleman, Merrill Newman. It is reckless because tours to North Korea produce the cash, the hard currency that the North Korean regime needs to continue proceeding with the development of long-range ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons.
Gordon?
Greg, in the early spring, February through about April, we saw a cycle of provocations, almost, one incident a day. And then the North Koreans go quiet for months. Is this the beginning, or do you think this is possibly the beginning of a new cycle of provocations from North Korea?
It may as well be, Gordon. And it is also clear that the new leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is simply playing by the father's playbook. And we are beginning to see old patterns reemerging. This new regime is no different from the previous one, and any perceived changes that we've seen in the media recently are simply cosmetic. The nature of the regime has not changed.
The puzzle here is, this is a break in pattern to my reading, Greg. He's 85. He's an infantry officer. He's an American veteran. He's not Korean national. He doesn't have Korean relatives. We're told that he learned Korean words looking to his adventure or his trip with his wife. Why take something so obviously in a break in pattern? That's what I'm trying to read here. They took him off an aircraft. They waited right till the end, right? They were ready to leave. Okay, it's a shakedown. But they certainly must be aware of the fact that there are parts of the United States that react ferociously to this kind of provocation. This isn't a Christian missionary serving God and taking risks. This is a veteran.
I am quite familiar with the mindset of the North Korean regime and with the viciousness of the Kim regime. It may simply be a matter of thinking that, okay, they have taken a Korean-American Christian hostage. They have taken a Korean-American Christian missionary hostage. America is not giving them any ransom, and no former presidents are traveling to North Korea, and thus they're simply rising the stakes by committing this outrageous act of taking an 85-year-old senior citizen hostage.
Right. Gordon?
So, Greg, should we send President Clinton to Pyongyang as we did to get those two current TV reporters out, or is that giving in to the blackmail?
We need to get these two gentlemen out of North Korea. And that said, we need to be very careful not to set a precedent, because we have already set that precedent, and the North Koreans already expect former President Clinton or some former very senior official to travel to North Korea to rescue these hostages. When we deal with hostage takers in other parts of the world, we tend to be very resolute in our approach to those situations. For some strange reason, in the case of North Korea, every time they have taken an American national hostage, we have bestowed the great honor upon them of sending such former senior government officials to rescue the hostages there. So I think we have created a dangerous precedent. But the bottom line is that we need to rescue these two gentlemen.
Is this news in Seoul? Is it shrug? You know, business as usual. How's it playing?
Well, certainly South Koreans are paying attention. They do keep a keen eye on what happens, and the South Koreans have been following the case of Kenneth Bae. And I have to admit, this is a terrible thing to say, but I have heard South Koreans saying that not enough has been done to rescue Kenneth Bae, possibly because he's an American of Korean descent. Unfortunately, the North Koreans might have thought along the same lines, and now they proceeded with taking the second gentleman hostage.
Gordon, I want to press you on this. How do you read the North Koreans? Put him on war crimes trial? Are they capable of that, Gordon?
Well, I suppose that they are. I wouldn't expect them to do that because that would just outrage the American public. But, you know, the North Koreans are capable of misreading us. So I guess I have to say, you know, as Greg talked about earlier, this regime is capable of anything, and so therefore we can't rule anything out at this point.
It was on the 26th, Greg. You heard about it a few days ago, but this is weeks later. What have they been up to? They've been trying to get him out with money, trying to tell them to do something. Why the delay in telling us? We've
John,
just got 20 seconds, Greg. Go ahead.
I don't know. Word travels fast within our community of North Korea watchers and North Korean human rights experts and advocates. But I just don't have enough information to give you a definite answer on the current circumstances. What happened there, evidence of North Korea's war crimes is displayed inside North Korea's museums. The picture IDs of American servicemen who went missing in action are displayed at North Korea's
Greg
museum.
Greg Scarlatu, the executive director of the Committee for Human Rights, Gordon Chang. I'm Forbes.com.